Welcome back to the Sciences Po Energy Podcast. My name is Olivia Vallada and I am a master's student here at Sciences Po. So today we are privileged to have Anton Root joining us to share his valuable insights into the dynamic landscape of the voluntary carbon market. With also COP28 recently concluding, it will be especially interesting to understand how the outcomes of this conference will also affect the market. So today we hope to give our listeners, you all, a more comprehensive understanding of the market itself, also address market trends and future developments, and look into its criticisms. So our guest, Anton, is currently the head of research at Allied Offsets, a tech company committed to enhancing transparency in the carbon market. He holds a bachelor's in journalism from NYU and a master's in economics from SOAS University. And additionally, he has been appointed as co-chair at the Climate Action Data Trust. So welcome, Anton. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've just provided a brief introduction of you, but it would be lovely to hear more about your role at Allied and also the story of how you ended up at Allied.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I've been working at Allied Offsets for about 3 years. I had been working with our founder on a previous company for about 6 years before that. So he and I go way back, and we really kind of fell into the carbon markets almost accidentally, to be honest. We were coming into the space from a data, tech, finance background, not really climate or commodities background like a lot of folks in the space. But you know, I think that actually had some advantages for us because we had a different perspective on things and could kind of come up with interesting solutions that maybe folks that were a little bit more entrenched in the market might not have thought about. So the first thing we did was we started to aggregate information around projects in the voluntary carbon market, and we started with some of the biggest projects in the world first. And that got us to about 10,000 projects globally. So you could see, you know, who is putting up your renewable energy plants in, you know, places like Tanzania versus planting forests in Colombia versus doing clean cookstove projects in Vietnam, et cetera. And that was really the start. And we grew it from there, adding more and more data, more and more information around what projects there are globally, how many credits they're issuing and retiring, and who's buying credits from those projects, how much are they paying, and a lot more interesting data like that. So that's how we got started. And over the last couple of years, we've sort of grown the database, have started to build up a client list, and have essentially been able to create a nice little startup around this idea in this industry.
Yeah, and it's grown quite big then. And that's what I'm interested in. It's more how initially did you manage to find the data, and what type of data was it that you were looking for and thinking that your clients would be interested in? Because that must have been a challenge then compared to now when there's more companies maybe similar on the market.
Sure. So interestingly enough, all of these projects are actually meant to report a lot of information through the registries. So just to take a quick step back, every project in the world is listed on a registry. And a registry is essentially just the ledger that is held by a standard setting body. So a standard setting body you might have heard of might be Verra, Gold Standard, the Clean Development Mechanism, American Carbon Registry, Clean Action Reserve, places like that. And what those entities do is they sort of set the rules for the projects to follow. And then as projects get going and start sort of operating and reducing emissions or removing emissions from the atmosphere, they're listed in these registries. Now, the registries have information like the project location, the description, the name, the number of credits they will be issuing, how many credits have been taken out of circulation or retired. So the data is there, but every registry does it slightly differently. So a lot of what we do, and this is a fairly sort of basic part of what we do, but needs to be done nonetheless, is we sort of standardize all the data. We make sure that, you know, what one registry calls a retirement, another one might call a cancellation. So, you know, it's fairly straightforward data cleanup like that, but it's important if you want to understand what's happening in the market holistically. So we now look at 23 registries. These are primarily voluntary standards or voluntary registries. Some of them have some overlap with the compliance markets. But for the most part, these are essentially registries that are open to private sector entities who are looking at creating a project that has some sort of beneficial environmental impact. And then once that project is going, they can sort of measure the how much impact that project is having on either avoiding, reducing, or removing carbon dioxide emissions from the atmosphere. So that's about, now we talk about 30,000 projects. So it's quite a long list. And half of those are active and half are either pending or are no longer active. So they're kind of finished their operations.
Yeah. This was a nice dive into how the voluntary markets function. But if we take a little step back, then how does the voluntary market differ maybe from the compliance market? You were mentioning these registries and these projects. Are they separate or do they, as you were saying, sometimes they overlap with the compliance? And in your words, what are the key differences then from the voluntary compared to the compliance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll start with the voluntary market first, just because it's a little bit, I think, easier to understand. But on the voluntary side, the projects can be set up really by anyone. So imagine you are looking to set up a project that's planting trees in your country. So what you would do is you would look for a standard and a methodology that has a geographic fit and then has a fit with the type of project you're trying to set up. So imagine you're looking to plant pine trees here in the UK, for example. There is a standard here that allows you to sort of quantify how much carbon would be sequestered by those trees. And that allows you to issue credits against that methodology once the project is up and running. So the key thing about the voluntary market is this is all voluntary, of course, as the name suggests. And that means this is sort of individuals, companies, organizations, but they're all doing this in a way that, no one's forcing them to either set up these projects or to buy these credits and sort of offset using these using credits from the projects. So the dynamic here is the demand is coming from companies that want to be that want to be green, that want to signal to their consumers that they're doing the right thing and reducing or offsetting their emissions. And that's about it. I mean, there's really no other reason for companies to do this other than to say, we have a role to play in global emissions and in creating climate change, and we want to do something about it. So that's the voluntary market. On the compliance side, of course, again, as the name suggests, the companies that are regulated and need to do something around their emissions, that's where the compliance market comes in. So that can happen on many different levels. But for example, in California, if you're a company of a certain sector that's of a certain size in terms of emissions, you have to sort of cap the amount of emissions you have. And if you are over that, you need to essentially buy emission reductions from your competitors. So essentially you're capping a sector and saying any company within that sector that's over the cap needs to buy allowances from companies that are under the cap. So the incentive, of course, is for companies to then clean up more quickly, clean up their emissions, and that allows them to A, have an extra revenue stream by being able to sell these credits and to their competitors. But of course, it's environmentally it's good for the entire industry. So that's one type of compliance market, and that's typically what's called a cap and trade or emission trading scheme. Another type is essentially a straight tax. So in Colombia, for example, again, if you're a certain entity that's of a certain size within a certain sector, you have to pay a tax for every single one of your tons of carbon dioxide emitted. And that's, that is just essentially a polluter pay principle mechanism where the polluters are paying into the tax coffers of the government. So that's the compliance market. And the two are starting to merge. So we're seeing more and more a willingness from compliance markets and from regulators to admit certain type of voluntary projects and voluntary credits into the compliance markets. So what I mean by that, and just to go back to the example in Colombia, so a certain part of a polluter's tax that they have to pay can be done through offsets. So for example, if you need to pay tax on 100,000 tons of emissions, up to a certain percentage, you can say, well, instead of paying tax, I'm actually going to be offsetting for, let's say 10% of my emissions. So that generates obviously a lot of demand for voluntary carbon credits in that country. And that helps the voluntary sort of space to flourish. But it also means that these projects are no longer just voluntary. If those credits can now be used in compliance markets, that's a typically a beneficial thing for those projects.
Mm. So it was interesting that you said that they're emerging more and more, and maybe we'll talk more about that when it comes to Article 6, right? But what's more interesting, or would be interesting to know, is what type of companies comes then to Allied? What type of institutions? Is it then people from the compliance that actually need to buy carbon credits? Or is it more than private businesses, private organizations that wants to contribute and come to Allied then to better understand or which credits to buy? Could you even maybe name certain companies that are looking for these types of carbon credits?
Sure. So most of our clients fall in a few or a couple of different buckets. So we have academia, research organizations, consulting firms, folks like that are looking to understand more general market trends. Then we have some larger polluters who are looking to better understand, as you say, what projects might be of interest and how much they should be paying for those credits. And then finally, we have a lot of users who are sort of somewhere in the middle. So they are in the middle between the project and the ultimate buyer. So either they're investing in projects or helping to trade credits or are perhaps insuring projects and delivery of credits. So a lot of those entities need data to understand potential opportunities, and that's where we come in. So we've worked with a lot of different organizations, financial institutions, energy firms, consulting firms. I think some of our clients are on our website, but it's a pretty wide variety of companies.
Yes, indeed. There's many listed on the website. And then the following question becomes, why does the voluntary carbon market need companies like Allied Offsets. Would it work without them, or do you think they are an important, obviously, asset to it for its development?
Well, I think, you know, any market that kind of is looking and hoping to grow needs to have really good information around it. Because if you don't have the data, if you don't have information to help entities in the market make well-informed decisions, it ends up being, you know, something that's suboptimal for everyone involved. So what I mean by that is, you know, when we first started out, there wasn't much data around what folks should be paying for credits. And really that typically hurt the project developers more so than the buyers, because the large buyers, they know typically how much, you know, credits are going for. And they might, you know, so they kind of had that information. Whereas if you're a small project developer who, you know, your expertise might be planting trees or, you know, working with farmers to reduce their emissions, or, you know, you might be a solar energy developer, that doesn't mean you know anything about the carbon market. So with the data that we have, you know, we can help them negotiate better deals, and to provide information around who might be interested in credits from their project. So that's one example. Of course, a lot of our clients use the data to understand who might be interested in buying credits. A lot of our clients use the data to understand what's the success rate of project developers. And all of that information allows, you know, for more efficient investment and transactions, and that hopefully will mean that the industry has a better sort of footpath on which through which to grow.
Yeah, and what I personally see is that companies such as Allied Offset can maybe help address the criticisms that the voluntary market faces. Especially in recent years, it's been a lot of focus on the carbon credits itself, right? That the methodologies are not rigorous enough, and which form of carbon credits are more high quality credits, as you call it. And is that something you think is important for the development of the voluntary market, that there are more companies checking the rigorousness of the and the quality of these carbon credits? Or how do you think we should move forward and make these carbon credits more legitimate?
Yeah, so we answer that question in a couple of different ways, but the first thing I'll say is, you know, as I said at the very beginning, we don't come from environmental sciences background or anything like that. So, you know, pretty early on, we decided not to rate projects or try to determine the quality of projects ourselves. So that was a pretty big decision for us to have made when we were first launched, because really that was one of the key fundamental questions in the market. And as you rightly point out, that remains to this day. But the way we help companies and our clients and other folks more broadly in the market is through partnering with experts. So we partner with B0, Renostre, and Silvera, three of the sort of preeminent carbon offsetting quality ratings companies. And what those companies do is sort of like a Moody's or a Fitch. They will go out and kind of run their calculations, do an assessment, and say this project, you know, is either good and is doing what it's meant to be doing, or it's not as good and it's, you know, we think it's actually doing half the good or a third of the good that it had initially claimed in its sort of registration. So we, by sort of offering those ratings through our platform, we make it really easy for people to understand, you know, well, what do the experts and what do the scientists say about these various projects? So that's one way we can help the market. Another is just by, you know, understanding all of the various data points that are interesting to people. and trying to collect and show as much of that data as we can. So what I mean by that, I'll give two examples. So the first is there are often projects that are very close to one another. And if the projects come from the same registry, you know, it's fairly easy to check to make sure that the projects aren't overlapping, right? So you don't want to be claiming credits for trees that are growing in one place, but are being claimed by, you know, two projects essentially. So what we do on that front is we have mapped over 1,000 projects in the space. So we have, you know, literally drawn the shapefile on Google Maps, and you can see exactly where the projects are. And you can see, you know, are there any projects in their vicinity? And maybe even, you know, within the project itself, or you can see if there's any overlap. Now, that's not something that happens often, but it's certainly, you know, there's certainly some examples we've seen where the projects are very close to one another and may, in fact, be overlapping. And that's certainly something that should be investigated further. So that's one type of data we show. To go a little bit deeper, we also gather a lot of data from the project design documents. So these are documents that projects submit when they're sort of coming onto the registry. And that those projects essentially hold the calculations that the projects are making in order to determine how many credits they're going to be issuing. So you can, count and examine and sort of work backwards and understand, you know, this project is making these assumptions, it has taken these measurements, these are the equations it's kind of put forward. And that means, you know, year over year, this is the number of credits that this project is going to be issuing. So as the science around these projects evolves, we can pretty easily see, you know, which projects are using more or less conservative adjustments or calculations. And that allows us to see, you know, are some projects, you know, potentially going to be overcredited over others. So in the recent couple of days, there have been articles around overcrediting in the clean cookstove sector. And really, at the root of it is, you know, there's been more surveys done, more observations, and essentially the sort of the figures that had been sort of the latest science in the past have been updated. And that means a lot of the cookstove projects now, you know, should have been receiving fewer credits using the more conservative latest calculations from, you know, from more recent years. So with our data, you can flag, you know, which projects may be sort of may have been overcredited the most. And that's not to say the projects are doing anything wrong. You know, they were using sort of the best science at the time. But you can see, you can pretty easily tell which ones are, you know, are or are not sort of going to be above that threshold.
Yeah. So essentially, allied or by finding this data and providing this data to the clients or the stakeholders is to give, it's both helping maybe developing the voluntary market, but also giving everyone a better understanding of it, right? Since it's so new, do you think that's why it's been many challenges and issues of overcrediting or overlaps? Or do you think it's more that now when you found it, it's just people actually just trying to take the shortcut?
Well, you know, I think anecdotally, you certainly have both. You know, I think the issues in the market are real. You know, there wouldn't be this much criticism of the market if some of the issues weren't accurate. I think from our point of view, we try not to take a qualitative stand on, you know, whether projects are good or bad, or whether companies are, you know, using quote unquote good or bad credits. what we show and what we know is, you know, how old are the credits that companies purchase, you know, which companies purchase credits from methodologies that, you know, at the time might have been okay, but have since been sort of shown to be a little bit questionable. So, you know, with that information, you can tell quite a lot. And again, we're not saying, you know, a company or a project is good or bad, but, you know, you can draw your own conclusions from what is the latest science and, you know, the data, our data allows you to do that really quite easily and quite quickly.
Yes, indeed it does. So moving on then, when we're talking about the challenges, be interesting to better understand Article 6 as well, as Article 6 is in the Paris Agreement sets out the framework both for the compliance and the voluntary market. So I noticed that one Allied Offset had a representative at the COP28, right? So I was wondering what type, was there any outcomes during this meeting that you think would be beneficial for the voluntary market? And why is Article 6 so important, especially for the voluntary?
Thanks. Yeah. And I should preface all this by saying, you know, I'm not a legal expert. I'm not really even a policy expert. But yeah, Article 6, you know, is to do with the international sort of trade of emissions reductions. So what that means is, unlike the Kyoto Protocol, the Paris Agreement mandates every country to you know, set emissions reduction targets and start to, you know, hopefully get on the way to meeting those targets. In the Kyoto Protocol, that was mandated just for the developed wealthy nations. Now, a country that, you know, is meeting or even exceeding its targets, in theory, could sort of sell its emissions or emission reductions to a country that's struggling to keep up. So in a way, it's almost like the cap and trade system or the emissions trading scheme that that I talked about earlier. So every country needs to be setting these goals, needs to start making its way to them. And, you know, when you think of a country that has a lot of forest coverage, for example, so if you look at a country like Indonesia, for example, you know, in theory, the country can claim, you know, the sort of benefits or the emission reductions from its forests and say, okay, well, we're exceeding our pathway, and we're going to sell our sort of excess credits or emission reductions to a country that's struggling to meet its targets. Now, let's say you're a voluntary carbon offset project in Indonesia, and you know, you have a tree project, a forest project. What does that mean for you, right? Because in theory, all of the land in the country is effectively, I mean, it's the government's, you know, a government can lay claim to it. So what does that mean for you as someone who holds, you know, a small plot of land that's generating carbon credits? And that's really what the Article 6 and Article 6.4 more specifically is about. It's looking at how do we deal with the voluntary market, or how do we deal with these projects within this sort of national system of, or international system really, of carbon crediting and trading and sort of looking at more holistically from a global perspective. So yeah, Article 6.4 is really the key one. So one of the sort of, I guess, disappointments of COP is that there was no conclusion on Article 6.4. So that means, you know, while there was progress in sort of setting up the draft text around how this system would work, nothing was actually decided. And that means a lot of projects, and especially in countries where, you know, there's a lot of interest from the governments in participating in the system. You know, they're a little bit in a gray area in terms of, you know, how will they be operating. And really at the core of the issue is the concept of corresponding adjustment. And what that means is, you know, if you are that Indonesian forestry project and the government says, hey, we see you, we recognize what you're doing, you know, really that government should be kind of excluding your project from their overall sort of balance sheet or ledger of emission reductions that the country is doing. So every country needs to be adjusting its, you know, its emission reductions to account for these private or public or whatever, but these voluntary carbon projects. And because this system hasn't been clearly set up, it puts the voluntary projects in a little bit of limbo. And unfortunately, because COP only happens once a year, you know, there's really no opportunity to move more quickly than, you know, basically until COP of this year in Baku towards the end of the year. So
is that, if I may just jump in, is Article 6, since the voluntary market is voluntary, right, depends on businesses and organizations, is Article 6 so defining? Is it very important? Is there other ways, like you told, you mentioned before, other standards such as VERA and gold standards, if they play as an important role? Or it's COP28, which is also as important for the voluntary compliance?
Let's say, I think maybe this will be clear if I give an example. So let's say you are a company that wants to offset part of its emissions, and you're looking at a voluntary carbon project. So you might be thinking, oh, there's a great project in Indonesia or in Kenya. I'm going to be buying credits and I'm going to adjust my emissions or sort of offset my emissions with these credits from this project in Indonesia, let's say. Now, that's all well and good, but imagine you're in the Indonesian government and you're saying, well, this entire tree, like all the trees in our country generate, you know, lots of carbon reductions because they absorb the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So we're going to count all the trees in our land as, you know, reducing emissions, and we're going to put that on our country's balance sheet. So we're saying, let's say a country like Indonesia might have, you know, 100 million, this is complete made up number, but 100 million tons of carbon dioxide emission reductions. And you as that one sort of project in Indonesia might be 1/100 of that, so 1 million. So if a company wants to buy those 1 million tons, that means the Indonesian government now needs to take a million off its ledger. So now they should be saying, well, we had 100 million tons of carbon being removed, but there's this private project that we're, you know, seeing and recognizing, and it sold its credits to this third party. So that means we should no longer be claiming that million tons of carbon, because otherwise we'd be double counting, right? The country is claiming those credits, as is the private sector voluntary project. So that's where the country's balance sheet has to be adjusted. And that's why this is called corresponding adjustment, to account for, you know, any issuances and retirements coming from projects, voluntary projects that are happening within these countries. So that's really at the heart of the matter. And again, nothing, you know, nothing concrete has been established to sort of make that accounting clear and sort of equitable across all these different countries, or equal across all these different countries. So we, you know, we have to wait another year to see what happens next.
Is it really just that both the compliance and the voluntary market needs to wait, or is there something else you think can be bettered or developed throughout the year until the next one?
So some countries, and two in particular so far, they are Rwanda and Malawi. They have come out and said, you know, we realize that there's no system that's been set up, but we want to encourage these voluntary projects. And we are issuing letters of intent or letters of authorization saying that these projects, you know, whatever the system ends up looking, we will recognize them. So this is kind of a way to say, well, nothing 100% legal has been set up or regulatory has been set up. But when the time comes, we will be recognizing these projects and we will be, you know, making sure to adjust our country's balance sheets in order to account for them. So it's been a couple of months since COP, and that's sort of the best we've seen so far. And anecdotally, we've seen projects from those countries, from Rwanda and Malawi, you know, really start to sort of get a higher price in the market because buyers are recognizing that, you know, even though this is still very tentative, and even though, you know, things might change in the future, at least there's a strong signal from the government saying, you know, they will recognize these projects and they are willing to work with them and make sure there's no double counting.
Interesting. Interesting that at least two countries have come out and said something. But otherwise, that's a shame that another year needs to be another year of waiting before more concrete actions can be taken. But then for the last couple of minutes, it would be interesting to move on to just briefly CDR. So I know that Allied Offset also analyzes CDR, and CDR is short for carbon dioxide removal, which is basically another form of tech tool then, or another form of emission reduction, where you capture carbon and you store it either geologically or in ocean reservoirs. So my question is, how do you then think for CDR, which is this even newer development, is that something that you think will move into the voluntary market? And how is that developing? Because I've been watching Allied or following Allied, and now more and more data is coming out of that. And it seems like more stakeholders are also interested. So how is the CDR market developing?
Yeah, so CDR is still very new. They're only, you know, that whole system I explained at the very beginning of standards and registries and data being uploaded to, you know, a pretty comprehensive database that all of these registries have. That doesn't really exist yet. So we've seen some standards emerge and they're setting up these registries. But because the technologies are often so new, there's really no easy way to understand what data is even going to be generated or what data is going to be required from these projects in order to, you know, have a well-functioning sort of registry and market ecosystem. So having said that, there are some projects. Some of the more sort of advanced ones are biochar projects. That's where waste or purpose-grown biomass is pyrolyzed, and instead of the sort of emissions being emitted into the atmosphere, they are stored in essentially carbon here on Earth, and that can be used as a fertilizer, it can be used as a water purifier. There's lots of different ways to use biochar. So that's one of the more advanced sort of technologies out there. And then another one, of course, is direct air capture. That's one of the ones that's certainly grabbed a lot of attention and headlines, but is, you know, still fairly new. And in terms of the actual impact on emissions, or on carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you know, it's very small. I mean, we're talking at best, all of CDR is about a couple of million tons of carbon removed every year, and that's probably quite optimistic even. And of course, with global emissions being at over 55 billion, in recent years, it's really a very small part of the overall ecosystem at the moment. However, it, you know, it has a lot of potential. There's a lot of interest. And the good thing about CDR projects is it's a lot easier to actually quantify the carbon dioxide removed. And that means there are fewer issues around, you know, integrity, quality. You can essentially measure and see the carbon dioxide that you've captured. And that means there are no issues in terms of looking to extrapolate, you know, how many tons of carbon could be avoided if you were to set up this project, which you can essentially never get right. So in lots of ways, it's a big improvement for the market, but we'll see if it can, you know, scale up as quickly as it's needed.
Yeah, so if it is set better quality, integrity, and even easier to quantify, what are the main challenges of its scaling up then?
So the key challenge is cost. So if you look at the cost of carbon credits in the sort of more traditional voluntary market, at the moment they're going for about, you know, $1 to $10 a ton for the most part. If you look at CDR credits, you know, it's really hard to find anything under, you know, $120 a ton. So really anywhere from 100 to 10 times more expensive. And then if you look at direct air capture, those are, you know, anywhere from typically $500 per ton to $1,000 per ton. So, you know, there are only a few companies that are willing and able to pay that much to capture carbon from the atmosphere. So that's one of the key challenges. And the other is, you know, the technology is still very nascent. So that means it's inefficient. It's fairly, you know, it's hard to scale up. And especially with something like direct air capture, you know, it's pretty energy intensive. So that means you need to ensure that the energy that these direct air capture plants are using is clean. So you can't have, you know, fossil fuels powering these DAC facilities, because otherwise, you know, they will effectively be emitting more than they actually capture. So that's why you see a lot of them in places like Iceland or in Kenya in the Rift Valley, where there is a lot of geothermal energy, which means, you know, it's really clean and allows you to set up the plants and not have to worry about how much they're emitting as they're capturing the carbon.
Yeah. So the latter challenge, hopefully, the students at Sciences Po can come up with a solution to, as we're studying energy. But the first one, my question is then, do you think that this is something that governments should invest in? Should they rather invest more in the development of CDR, or maybe focus on the compliance market in general? Or is that even comparable? Is it two different things?
No, we're certainly seeing governments step in. So in the US, the Inflation Reduction Act has given a lot of sort of tax benefits and tax credits to companies that are capturing carbon. It's also just given a lot of money for sort of pilots, there's also a dedicated pod for the US government to actually buy removals themselves. So, you know, in the US and also in the EU, the European Union is looking at integrating CDR into the EU emission trading scheme, which is sort of the biggest compliance market globally. So, you know, there are definitely moves being made to incorporate CDR into compliance markets, and governments are playing a bigger role. But, you know, again, one of the issues is because this sort of registry infrastructure system has not yet been set up, you know, it's hard to know, like, how credits will be quantified, you know, who will be allowed to even audit these projects if, you know, if that's going to be part of the system. Is that going to be part of the system? Or will we just say, well, you know, this direct air capture facility, you know, it has a meter and you can sort of see how much it's capturing, you know, but, you know, is that good enough, essentially? So a lot of this is still being worked out. But certainly the sort of policy landscape has been quite friendly to direct air capture. We'll see what happens. You know, if Donald Trump gets elected in the States, what does that mean for U.S. clean energy policy and policy when it comes to CDR? Though so far, most of the CDR sort of funding has been, you know, welcomed by both Democrats and Republicans. So it's actually possible that Donald Trump getting elected might not actually affect CDR specifically very much, even though it probably will affect other parts of the energy policy. So yeah, so it's an interesting question as we move into 2024.
It is. So it seems like a very new market, a new landscape, both for the voluntary market and the emergence of CDR, and especially that it's so affected by policy and also which government is in place. So my last question is then, for the upcoming year, 2024, what should we look out for in the voluntary carbon market? What should we expect to happen, and or what do you hope for the market to develop into?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, I mean, we covered the compliance overlap between the voluntary and the compliance market. And, I think that's something that's going to continue to get bigger as we move into 2024. So I think more compliance markets are looking at voluntary carbon projects as a sort of potential way to enable more projects to get off the ground. So I think we'll continue to see more of that. I guess time will tell. But on the other hand, I'd say within the voluntary market itself, I think there's been much more of an emphasis on quality. And what that means is, we're looking at industry-led initiatives. For example, the ICVCM, which is the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market, they are putting out some draft guidelines around what qualifies as a good quality project. And that's really the first time that, the industry itself is coming out and taking a stand and saying that we think these are good projects. We think, they're not so good projects. But because this is an industry-led initiative, it remains to be seen, how rigorous and how exclusionary it's going to be, because, obviously there are vested interests and a lot of folks with a lot of credits in the market that probably would not clear the quality bar. So there are things like that happening. And more broadly, I think we've seen standards and registries evolve a little bit, and they're now including a lot more sort of new technologies, real-time satellite monitoring, for example, for forestry projects. As those things start to become a bigger part of the ecosystem, I think it'll be a lot easier to understand what is a good project and which projects have been delivering on their promises. And, hopefully that means that the industry can sort of move past its, it's not so great year in 2023 with a lot of questions around quality. But again, even if there are some interesting new fancy projects and methodologies and interesting standards doing interesting work, you have to remember that the vast majority of the projects in the market today and the vast majority of the credits that are in the market today still come from these projects and, from these older methodologies that have these legacy issues. And, unless those are taken out of circulation in some way, we'll still see companies sort of continue to buy these kind of disreputable credits. It's probably not their fault either. I mean, those are just the credits that are in the market right now. And until the sort of the higher quality ones, the more interesting newer ones get issued, there just won't be much, much else in the market essentially. So we'll see. I think definitely, compliance and quality are the two buzzwords in the industry right now. So we'll see if, those trends continue to play out in 2024.
Indeed. And I feel like the word that could summarize it is possibly potential that could go both ways. it has potential for 2024, but let's see what happens in the next COP then, since it's quite essential for the future development of the market then, for both the compliance and the voluntary. Well, thank you then very much, Anton, for joining us today and for sharing your very thorough insights. I think this definitely will help our listeners to piece together a little bit more how everything fits together, because, you know, there's a Kyoto Protocol, there's a Paris Agreement, there's a compliance, there's a voluntary, then we have these registries and these projects that could be within both. So it's a lot to keep track of, but once you get it, then hopefully you can more easily follow it. So thank you, Anton, and thank you to our listeners who's been listening to the Sciences Po Energy podcast that's been produced and recorded by me. If you like the podcast, feel free to leave a review. And if you are a student interested in the International Energy Transition Masters here at Sciences Po, feel free to check out our program on the website. Otherwise, I'll see you next time. Thank you again.